This is VOA.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Coming up on the program, I report on power outages in Ukraine's hospitals, Mario Ritter Jr. has a story on fig trees, and John Russell presents this week's science report on facial recognition technology used to study seals. Later, we present the next part in our American History series. But first, Russian strikes have cut off power across Ukraine, including many hospitals. The power outages added more pressure on the country's already weakened healthcare system. Medical operations, or surgeries, are being delayed. Patient records are unavailable because of internet outages. Dr. Oleh Duda was in the middle of a complex surgery at a hospital in Lviv, Ukraine, when he heard explosions. Moments later, the lights went out. Duda had to keep working with only a headlamp for light. The lights came back 3 minutes later, but those fateful minutes could have cost the patient his life, the surgeon told the Associated Press. The operation took place on November 15th. That day, the city in western Ukraine suffered outages as Russia launched missiles at Ukraine's energy supply. The attacks damaged nearly 50% of the country's energy facilities. The World Health Organization, or WHO, said last week that Ukraine's health system is facing its darkest days in the war so far. The organization noted the growing energy crisis, the beginning of cold winter weather, and other difficulties. Dr. Hans Kluge is the WHO's director for Europe. He said that 2 million to 3 million more people could leave their homes in search of warmth and safety. He said that could cause more health difficulties, including spreading infections like COVID-19, pneumonia, and flu. Attacks have hit hospitals and other health centers in southeastern Ukraine, too. The WHO said in a statement that they have confirmed at least 703 attacks since the war began. Russia claims it does not target civilian facilities. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said last week that Russia is targeting only structures directly or indirectly related to military power. But last week, a strike on a maternity center in a hospital in eastern Ukraine killed a newborn baby and heavily wounded two doctors. And two people were killed in the northeastern Kharkiv area after the Russian forces hit a health center. In Lviv, Duda said the explosions were so close to the hospital that the walls were shaking. Doctors and patients had to seek shelter underground. Across Kherson, it starts to get dark after 4 p.m. in late November. So doctors are using headlamps, phone lights, and flashlights to work. In some hospitals, important equipment no longer works. Health Minister Viktor Liashko said on Friday that there are no plans to shut down any of Ukraine's hospitals, no matter how bad the situation gets. Liashko said that generators have been provided to all hospitals. There will be 1,100 more generators sent by the country's Western allies in the coming weeks. A generator is a machine that uses fuel to create electricity. And the hospitals have enough fuel to last 7 days. More generators are still badly needed, the minister added. The generators are designed to work for a short period of time, 3 to 4 hours, but outages can last up to 3 days, Liashko said.
Fig trees are native to Europe, around the Mediterranean Sea, Asia, and Africa, but they can grow in much cooler climates. Once mature, fig trees can accept temperatures even a few degrees below freezing. Some kinds of fig trees do better in such environments than others. Associated Press gardening expert Jessica Damiano recently wrote about caring for fig trees. She said all kinds of the trees could use protection. Depending on the weather and pruning, a fig can grow into a shrub or a tree. Shrubs with several stems growing from the ground do best if covered for the winter. Trees with a single stem or trunk can be either covered or buried. Either way, wait until the trees have dropped most of their leaves. One popular method for burying trees for their protection is called the Minnesota tip. It involves digging a narrow, shallow area where the tree can be laid. The space should be about 30 centimeters deep, 60 centimeters wide, and as long as the tree is tall. To prepare the tree, gather its branches and tie them together with soft rope. Next, push a shovel into the soil about a half meter from the trunk on the side opposite the hole. Lift that side of the tree's root ball out of the ground. Then, gently push the tree toward the hole. When it is lying flat, cover the tree with plastic. Pack soil around the exposed side of the roots and around the length of the tree. Load soil over the tree. Make it at least 30 centimeters deep. You will need more soil than you removed from digging. If you are covering or wrapping the tree instead, you will need cardboard, a pail, and a roll each of burlap, heavy brown paper, and tar paper. If the tree is under 3 years old, cut it back by one-third its size. Then pull the branches inward and tie them together with soft but strong rope. Working upwards from the bottom, put burlap around the tree. Then put heavy brown paper around the burlap and tie it into place. Remove some soil from around the base of the tree. Place a large piece of cardboard into the space and bend it around the bottom half of the tree. Tie the cardboard into place. Next, wrap tar paper around the tree. Position it outward from top to bottom. This will direct rain away from the tree. Place soil around the tree's base, creating a little hill. Place a pail upside down over the top of the tree to keep the rain off. Unwrap the tree on a cloudy day in early spring, soon after the last frost. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr. Thank you.
Scientists believe they have found a new use for facial recognition technology, saving large ocean animals known as seals. Researchers at Colgate University in the U.S. state of New York have developed SealNet. The system is a database of seal faces created by taking pictures of many harbor seals in Maine's Casco Bay. The research team found the tool's accuracy in identifying the mammals was close to 100%. The researchers are working on increasing the size of their database to make it available to other scientists, said Krista Ingram. She is a biology professor at Colgate and a team member. Increasing the database to include rare species such as the Mediterranean monk seal and Hawaiian monk seal could help efforts to save those species, she said. Creating a list of seal faces and using machine learning to identify them can also help scientists know where in the ocean seals are, Ingram said. She said, "For marine mammals that move around a lot and are hard to photograph in the water, we need to be able to identify individuals." SealNet is designed to identify the face in a picture. It recognizes the seal's face based on information related to the eyes and nose shape, as it would a human. A similar tool called PrimeNet, that is for use on primates, had been used on seals earlier, but SealNet performed better, the Colgate researchers said. The Colgate team published its findings last spring in Ecology and Evolution. They processed more than 1,700 images of more than 400 individual seals, the paper said. The paper stated that the SealNet software could be a valuable tool in the developing field of conservation technology, technology aimed at saving and protecting wild animals. Harbor seals are a conservation success story in the U.S. More than 100 years ago, the animals were once widely killed. But the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which turned 50 in October, gave them new protections, and populations began to come back. Seals and other ocean mammals have long been studied using satellite technology. Using artificial intelligence to study them is a way to bring conservation into the 21st century, said Jason Holmberg of WildMe. The Oregon-based company works to bring machine learning to biologists. WildMe is developing a possible partnership with SealNet. Facial recognition technology could provide valuable data, said Michelle Berger, an associate scientist at the Shaw Institute in Maine. Berger was not involved in the SealNet research. Once the system is perfected, I can picture lots of interesting environmental uses for it, Berger said. If they could recognize seals and recognize them from year to year, that would give us lots of information about movement, how much they move from site to site. The Colgate researchers are also working with Fruit Punch, a Dutch artificial intelligence company, to improve some parts of SealNet to help more scientists use it, said Tjom Duper, Fruit Punch's head of partnerships and growth. That would open new opportunities to study the animals and help protect them, he said. What this does is help the biologists study the behavior of seals and also population dynamics, Duper said. He added that harbor seals give important information about the environment around them. I'm John Russell.
You just heard this week's science report from John Russell. John joins me now to talk more about the story. Welcome, John.
Hi, Dan. Glad to be back.
Your report explores an interesting use of facial recognition technology. Some of the sources in your story suggest SEALNET could be used to study population dynamics. Could you explain the term a little more?
Sure. Let's start with the term dynamics. Dynamics suggests a pattern of change or growth. The term is also used in music to describe the changes in how loudly a song is played.
So music dynamics can suggest changes in music. Population dynamics can suggest changes in a population. The population can increase or decrease. The population can also become older or younger, on average.
That's right. And the term population can be used both with people or animals. So you might study the population dynamics of seals, as in the science report, or you might study the population dynamics of a country.
Thanks for explaining the term to us, John.
You're welcome. See you next time.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the 1820s, in the state of New York, a man named Joseph Smith started the Mormon religion. Smith based it on what he said were God's words to the ancient people of America. Many people became members of the new church. Others, however, laughed at some of the beliefs of the Mormons. This led to trouble. Smith had to move his people many times. For a while, they settled in the state of Illinois, in a town they built and called Nauvoo. The church split when Joseph Smith said that Mormons could have more than one wife. The split led to violence and public opposition to the Mormons. Smith was arrested and put in jail. A mob attacked the jail and killed Smith and his brother. The governor of Illinois ordered the Mormons to leave the state. This week on our series, Sarah Long and Richard Rail discuss relations between the Mormons and the federal government.
Brigham Young became the new leader of the Mormons. He told his people that he had seen their new home in a dream. He said it was a wide, beautiful valley in the west. He said he would recognize it when he saw it. The Mormons left Illinois in the spring of 1846. There were more than 15,000 people and many wagons and farm animals. The trip west was hard. Many of the people died. After months of slow travel, they stopped to make their winter camp.
Explorers visited the camp. They told Brigham Young about a great salt lake in a wide valley on the western side of the Rocky Mountains. From the way they described it, Young believed it was the valley of his dream. He started to move his people toward the Great Salt Lake as soon as the winter snows melted. They arrived in the summer of 1847. Brigham Young looked out over the valley. "This," he said, "is the right place."
The Mormons wasted no time. 2 hours after arriving, they began to prepare the ground for planting. The lake water was too salty to use, so they built a system of canals to bring water down from the mountains. The first few years were difficult. Cold weather and insects destroyed their crops. Yet the Mormons continued to work hard to make their settlement a success, they refuse to think of leaving.
At first, the Mormons were ruled only by the laws of their church and by their leader. Then gold was discovered in California. Many non-Mormons passed through the Salt Lake area on their way to the gold fields. Some of them stayed. It soon became clear that new laws were needed to govern the growing population. The Mormons asked Congress to approve a territorial government for their land. They called the land Deseret. That was a Mormon word meaning honeybee. The Mormons claimed a large area. It stretched from the mountains of Colorado west to the mountains of California, from Arizona north to Oregon.
Congress rejected the large claim of Deseret and made it a much smaller territory. It also refused to accept the name Deseret. Instead, Congress called it Utah, after the Ute tribe of Native American Indians that lived there. As a compromise, Brigham Young was named governor of the new Utah Territory. Most of the new territorial officials were Mormons, too. Four were not Mormon.
Governing the territory would not be easy. There were disputes during the administrations of several American presidents. As a result of one dispute, the four non-Mormon officials returned to Washington. The Mormons then formed their own territorial government with a legislature and courts. Other federal officials were sent to Utah. Some of them were not prepared for the job. Usually, they did not stay long.
Some of the officials made many charges against Brigham Young and other Mormon leaders. They said Mormons refused to recognize the power of the federal government. They said Mormons put the words of Young above the laws of Congress. They said the church had a secret organization to take the lives and property of those who questioned the power of the church. There were charges that Mormons had burned the papers of the Supreme Court of the territory. And there were charges that Mormons were responsible for Indian attacks on some officials. President Franklin Pierce decided he should make someone else governor of Utah. The man he chose, however, did not want the job. Instead, he urged the president to let Brigham Young remain. President Pierce agreed.
Relations between the Mormons and the government did not improve in the next 3 years. Territorial officials resigned. They charged that the Mormons were in open rebellion against the federal government. The next president, James Buchanan, dismissed Brigham Young as governor. He ordered more than 1,000 soldiers to go to Utah to put down the rebellion. He also sent a new governor, Alfred Cumming, with the soldiers. The Mormons prepared to fight. A small group of Mormon men attacked and destroyed the army's supply wagons. They forced the soldiers to stop for the winter before reaching the Salt Lake Valley. The soldiers could do nothing until spring.
In Washington, efforts were made to settle the dispute. A man named Thomas Kane asked President Buchanan to let him go to Utah. Cain was an old friend of the president. He also was a friend of the Mormons. He had spent much time with them during their long trip to Utah 10 years earlier. Cain feared what might happen to his Mormon friends if fighting started. He told President Buchanan that he did not want a job or money. He only wanted a chance to be useful. The president agreed to let him try to settle the dispute.
Thomas Cain arrived in Salt Lake City, the territorial capital, early in 1858. He found that the Mormons had decided not to fight. Instead, they were preparing to search for a new home. They talked of moving to Mexico, or perhaps to an island in the South Pacific. Cain talked with Brigham Young. Then he went to the army camp to talk with Governor Cumming. The governor agreed to go to Salt Lake City with Cain. The two men went alone, without any soldiers.
The Mormons welcomed Cumming, but continued their preparations to leave. Cumming called a public meeting. He said he was in Utah to represent the federal government. He said he was there to make sure the people of the territory obeyed the Constitution and the laws of the United States. He said he would not use military force until every other way had failed. Above all, said Cumming, he would not interfere with the Mormon religion. He urged the Mormons not to leave the land they had worked so hard to build. Brigham Young agreed to stay.
Governor Cumming returned to the army camp. He told the commander that the Mormons had accepted him. He said military force would not be needed. A few days later, two representatives of President Buchanan arrived. They brought news that the president would not act against Mormons who accepted the rule of the United States government. Brigham Young and the other Mormon leaders made a statement. They said they wished to live in peace under the Constitution and the laws of the United States. The dispute was over. Brigham Young continued to lead the Mormon Church, but the governor ruled the territorial government. The two jobs were separate and would remain that way.
Congressional elections were held in the United States in 1858. One political race created national interest. It was for one of the two Senate seats representing the state of Illinois. The candidate of the Democratic Party was Stephen Douglas. He was running for re-election. His opponent was a lawyer and a member of the Republican Party. His name was Abraham Lincoln. That will be our story next time.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.